owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We have been picked by MacArthur to retake Fortress Corregidor from the Japanese. This is our special honor. Those words were shared by a jump master with members of the 503rd Parachute Infantry Regiment under the wing of a transport plane just before they boarded to make a jump into, well, the equivalent of a postage stamp size landing zone. They would be the tip of the spear in a combined air and sea assault against some 6,700 Japanese defenders ready to fight to the death on the fortified island. Our guest today has covered military operations extensively for more than a decade. In 2003, he followed the 82nd Airborne Division during the initial invasion of Iraq. In 2010, he spent 10 weeks with a special forces team in Afghanistan and is also embedded with soldiers in East Africa and Haiti. His book, No Easy Day, about the mission to kill bin Laden, rose to number one on the New York Times bestseller list and was a top-selling hardcover book of all of 2012. His new book about the paratroopers who took Corregidor back from the Japanese during World War II goes on sale December 1st, but American Warrior Radio listeners will get a special preview. Kevin Maher, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Hey, Ben, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Kevin, you're an intriguing cat, a great author, a journalist by trade, and I'd like to introduce our listeners to our guests. So your first assignment covering military operations involved the invasion of Pineland. Is that correct?
It was one of my earlier assignments when I got to the Fayetteville Observer, right, in 2003. Mm-hmm.
Now, that's kind of an inside joke between you and me and every Green Beret in the world. Maybe you might want to explain that a little bit, Kevin.
Yeah, sure. So the easy explanation is the invasion of Pineland is part of the Robin Sage exercise, which is the Green Beret's final exam. So when you join Special Forces and you get through the qualification course, the last thing you've got to complete is you pretend to jump into a foreign country. It's called Pineland, and it's really just a collection of central North Carolina counties. But they do it just like real life. They'll helicopter infill. They'll actually, I've seen them where they've gone to Tennessee and hiked over the mountains. They'll parachute in, and you basically for 10 days or so you fight a counterinsurgency campaign where you link up with guerrillas and you pretend you're in this foreign country. And at the end of it, the U.S. invades to help liberate Pineland. So it's one of the more it's the cooler exercises I've ever experienced. And I've covered it, I don't know, a dozen times.
I tell you, one of my favorite interviews is with a Green Beret, Frank Antonori, and he described that a little bit. And he said the hardest part of the whole thing was trying to make sure the paperwork got filed. They were hungry, and they took two chickens from a farmer and cooked them and ate them. Well, you know, DOD being DOD, we had to make sure that farmer got a reimbursement for his two chickens. And that, according to Frank, that was the toughest part of that whole exercise. Kevin, why journalism, and did you choose to cover the military? Was it thrown in your lap the first time there in Fayetteville, or a little bit of both?
Well, I chose journalism mostly because it allowed me I was curious about other people, and it allowed me to sort of dabble in people's lives without committing. Journalism came post 9/11. I was working near the Pentagon for a newsletter publisher in Washington, covering OSHA of all things. And after the attacks on September 11th, I sort of realized that was the story I wanted to cover. And the Fayetteville Observer at the time had a military job open. So I left Washington and headed to North Carolina to Fort Bragg. I think within months, I started that job in January of 2003. And by March of 2003, I was in Iraq with the 82nd.
Well, question I've always wanted to ask, when you do that sort of thing, Kevin, do you receive any special training at all? I mean, do you need to know how to fire a weapon? Do they care as long as you stay out of the way? How does that work?
I mean, I've received no training whatsoever. When I got to Iraq, I got to Kuwait, they handed me a gas mask and a protective suit in case we got hit with a chemical weapon and said, when you hear the siren, put all this on and follow the crowd. So I was in pretty much in dire straits if we actually got hit with a chemical weapon. But with the guys that you embed with, particularly around special forces teams like to train you up. So most of the times what happens is when you get to an embed, the guys will take you aside. They'll show you their weapons. They'll show you just basically how they function. Green Berets particularly like to take you out to the range and let you shoot a little bit. But it's always the same joke. They always joke, you know, hey, if you have to use this weapon, we're all dead anyway. but no, I didn't have a lot of training. I did later on after a couple embeds I went and did some first aid training, and we had some situational awareness training with some Royal Marines. And we also did we all got taken hostage, and they taught us sort of how to survive that. But that was it.
Interesting. I've always found, I don't know, I wonder if sometimes, particularly with the special forces, when they're given an embed, if they're like, oh man, you know, here's somebody we've got to babysit, versus embracing you. But the reason I bring that up is it's interesting to me the themes that carry throughout your book. Rock Force also, playing in special forces today, the camaraderie and kind of the attitudes, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. I mean, you've had a great deal of success, Kevin. No Easy Day. I mean, holy cow, the number one selling book for a full year. That ain't bad.
No, I've been lucky. I've stumbled into some great stories and had a chance to tell some great stories. And we'll get to the themes, but one of the things that I think sort of weaves through most of my work is soldiers are soldiers, you know? Mm. When the shooting starts, when the combat starts, I don't care if you're ancient Greece or if you're modern day soldier, you know, you're there really to make sure the guy that's to the left and right of you goes home. And so I think there's something ingrained in all soldiers, which is why I think you see that pop up quite a bit in the work I've done.
What along those lines, and so this, if I'm not mistaken, sir, will be your eighth publication, your eighth book?
I think I'm the 10. Okay. I've got this one. Yeah, I think I'm at 10 now.
What was it about the retaking Corregidor during the Second World War in 1945 that particularly appealed to you?
Well, I was looking to do a World War II book, and I was speaking with Brent Howard, who's an editor at Dutton. He's my editor, and he and I were talking about different ideas around a World War II book, and he mentioned Corregidor because his grandfather jumped on Corregidor. And so I had very little knowledge of Corregidor. I knew it was an airborne operation. I knew it was in World War II in the Pacific, but I really wasn't aware of the details. So I sort of took that that little nugget and went home and really did some research. I went to the Special Operations Museum in Fayetteville and looked at what they had on it. And at the end of the day, I just was enamored with the whole story. It's an airborne operation that gets overshadowed by the 82nd and 101st in Europe. But it really is an amazing operation. And these guys are what they end up pulling off when they do it. Jump on Corregidor is really impressive.
Now, Kevin, for people who don't follow history, they need to keep in mind that the paratrooper airborne concept was pretty much a new thing in the Second World War. I mean, we were still working out some kinks. Folks weren't really quite sure what the capacity of this type of tool was. The Germans had a somewhat disastrous experience. I think it was that on Crete.
It was.
So in that context, this I think that makes this story even more amazing.
Well, I think so too. I mean, you've got to remember that the airborne, like you said, is very new. The Americans are still figuring it out. And if you think of the drop zones that you get in Europe, right, these kind of they're much bigger. In Corregidor, they're jumping on the top of a hill it's 3 miles wide, and they're dropping onto a parade ground and a par three golf course at about 300 to 400 feet, and they don't have modern parachutes. So when you think of the mm-hmm. paratroopers now, you know, especially special operations guys, you know, when they hey-ho a high altitude, high opening, they can really kind of fly into where they need to fly into. These guys are jumping out with just, you know, parachute risers and a parachute, and they kind of have to really struggle to guide these things. So the fact that they hit and they had so few injuries is really a testament to their training.
And 300 feet, I mean, for most of you, if you're listening in a community that has a police helicopter, generally they're flying between 400 and 500 feet above your city. And these are paratroopers jumping out of a plane at 300 feet. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're speaking with best-selling author Kevin Marr about his new book, Rock Force. I read it. I enjoyed it. You can find out more. Visit kevinmaurer.net. That's M-A-U-R-E-R.net. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by best-selling author Kevin Maurer. His new book is called Rock Force. For our listeners in Phoenix and Sacramento, this should be on your shelves already. Check it out. You can always also learn more at kevinmaurer.net, M-A-U-R-E-R. Kevin, we talked about what fascinated you about Corregidor. Being a World War II sort of history buff myself, I read your book, honestly, in just about one sitting, maybe, you know, one and a quarter. And the thing I found interesting about it, sir, was the style, the nature of the storytelling you're using. It was almost like Kevin was embedded with those 503rd paratroopers right there at the time taking notes.
That was by design. I'm glad you picked that up. I mean, I really didn't try to write a definitive history. I really wasn't interested in the big muscle movements of the battle. I really wanted to get as close to the action with the soldiers that I possibly could. And I was able to do that because I used two unpublished manuscripts written by guys, Doc Bradford, who's the battalion surgeon, and Calhoun, Bill Calhoun, who's a platoon leader in F Company. And I just chose to follow them as close as I could, coffee breath close, if you will, because I wanted to bring that intimacy of the battle to you. And I wanted you to really have the experience that you had, Ben, which is sit down and read it. It reads as close to a novel as you can get. But I feel like my hope is that when you're done with it, you get a better sense of that individual soldier experience and sort of the sacrifices that they had to make in order to get and survive the battle.
You know, you absolutely did achieve that. A novel's probably a better word, because that's sort of the feel one gets as they're reading it. And that's probably part of the reason I enjoyed it. And I was able to sit down and go through it all in one sitting. Did you have a chance, Kevin, to meet any of these fellows, or had they all long passed before you got around to starting this project?
Bradford and Calhoun had passed. I did get one meeting with Tony Lopez, if you recall.
Okay.
Tony is
sure.
the BAR gunner. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. It just reminded me sort of, we had several of the actors that played roles in Band of Brothers on the show, and to a person, they recounted about how it was so critical to them that they accurately portray the real life soldier that they were, you know, acting. And many of them had a chance to get to know these guys and to develop relationships with them. And I almost got the feel, sir, that like they were committed to doing it right. That vibe came through in your book as well.
Well, that's high praise, my friend. I really, really appreciate that. I mean, I really did. When I went out to Texas and met Bill Calhoun's daughter, and she gave me a copy of his memoir, that was printed out on dot matrix paper, and it was in a beat up old red binder, and I had his handwritten notes on the side, and I still haven't sent it back to her yet, because I'm afraid to put it in the mail, because I just don't want it to get lost. I know that our postal service professionals will get it there, but I'm going to take it there myself, because it was important to me that I told this story correctly, and it was important to me that I got it as close to accurate as accurate as I possibly could. So that's high praise. I appreciate that.
Well, no worries. You also taught me something. And again, you know, I consider myself pretty informed, particularly when it comes to history, but I didn't realize that, and I don't know I think it was the 503rd, but there was actually the Army posted photos of them training on skis in Utah, I guess it was. That was, I don't know if that would come in handy, but it was really just all a ruse to convince Hitler that all these troops were going to Europe when really this group was going to the Pacific. Nowhere near snow.
Yeah, exactly. It was pretty crafty. That was a picture that Brent Howard, the editor, had, and that we had talked about, and we wanted to make sure we got that in there. Because the 503rd really is a special unit. I mean, it's an independent brigade. It was part of MacArthur's strategic reserve. And the fact that he had earmarked them to do this important mission, I think, speaks to what they'd already endured and the professionalism they brought to the mission.
people, when they read Rock Force, will get to know, feel like they personally get to know some of these. And I almost don't want to use the word characters because these were real men. But they are, I mean, you almost get sort of a Dirty Dozen feel. And right off the bat, what made me smile, Kevin, was the 503rd was not only good at liberating people, but also liberating supplies. And you said they Panama Jones and the 3,000 Thieves is what they were called. Tell us, Lieutenant Colonel Jones is sort of an intriguing cat. Tell us a little bit more about the General Patton of the Pacific Theater.
Well, Jones is really interesting because he's one of the first airborne officers. And, you know, his career takes him to Panama, where he's in charge of an airborne battalion down there. And that's where he picks up the name Panama Jones. But he's a rough and tumble professional soldier. And when he gets into World War II and into the Pacific Theater, you know, he's got a unit full of draftees, guys that have been pretty much conscripted into the military as the U.S. builds their capacity to fight two world wars on both sides of the globe. And so he treats these soldiers differently, which is something that you get into later in the book. But these guys are a Dirty Dozen feeling. I mean, you don't get a better Dirty Dozen character than Lloyd McCarter. He's 24 at the time, lumberjack from Washington, Iowa, who when he couldn't sit still, and when they are in peace and in garrison, he's off fighting with the Australians, and then he gets back just in time for a cricketer, and they got to get him out of the stockade. I mean, if I made him up and said I'm writing a World War II book about this guy, a fiction book, you'd tell me I went too far.
Kevin, honestly, if I could, now I've got a face for radio, so there's a reason I can't show you my notes, but literally I wrote him down, Lloyd McCarter, and you mentioned they had to liberate him from the brig just to do this mission. He eventually was awarded the Medal of Honor, though, for actions mm-hmm. there on Corregidor. We want you to come join us, be a scout. You need to use a Thompson Thompson machine gun. Don't know how to shoot it, no problem. We'll take you out in the jungle and teach you. And didn't work so well, but then when he developed his own shooting style, next thing you know, he's an ace. He's a natural.
That guy's amazing. I did as much digging as I could to get information on him, but I almost feel like the book is better that you don't have too much information from him, because he becomes, you know, there's a couple parts during the battle that he stands out, and particularly when they are facing that Banzai attack, and he really kind of stems the tide for them, and likely saved a lot of lives because they were driving towards the headquarters. So Lloyd McCarter to me is an amazing guy, and the things he says to Bill Calhoun are great. You know that Bill Calhoun loved him by the way he writes about Lloyd McCarter. And he writes so heartfelt about Lloyd and about how important Lloyd was to, I think, Bill's comfort and the way he led his platoon. I think, you know, McCarter is that kind of warrior that you need in a battle. And he's the guy that gets people home more often than not.
In many ways, though, he's the perfect warrior, but he's also a very sad case from that effect, in that he really only seems to feel joy when he's in combat. And he, as you mentioned before, if our troops weren't fighting, well, darn it, he was going to go find some that were. And the saddest part of this is eventually at 38 years old, he ends up taking his own life.
Yeah, I mean, Lloyd McCarter really, and I don't think we get into this enough with the World War II generation about what the war did to these guys. And I think the way Bill Calhoun talks about leaving Corregidor in his book, and I have it in Rock Force, about sort of the struggle with the losses that they took and reconciling what he had to do to survive it versus the guys that didn't make it. And same with Tony Lopez talking about he considers the guys that didn't make it the heroes. I think it just speaks to, you know, we write a lot about World War II, and I think what the guys that fought World War II did, you know, I think speaks for itself. I can't throw accolades more on what they did. But one of the things I've made a choice about doing is trying to show the toll of what it did and the sacrifice these guys made. I mean, they really, a lot of guys came back broken. And I think Lloyd McCarter is a good example of a guy who gave his country everything. There's really nothing else that he could give them. And it cut short his life.
And really, that speaks to what you've experienced and what even I've experienced in just nearly decade of doing this show is those commonalities across the generations. I mean, neither one of us interviewed a Spartan, but you would guess that some of those things, there really are some parallels, no matter which generation, which battle, which weapons. And that really came out to me again in your writing, Kevin, that there are things that don't change despite the generation. And unfortunately, that the downside, the ugly side, the mental side, the 22 a day side of war is something that hasn't changed.
No, I don't think it has. And I think, you know, I think you're absolutely right. I think if we interviewed Spartans, that we'd have the same thing. The two things I think that we could bet across the board for soldiers is one is that sense of duty and sacrifice to something greater than them, but also to the men to the left and right, and that trumps everything. And then the other piece I think is that they would never want to talk about it. They just want to talk about the funny stuff. So the Spartans don't want to talk about, you know, the funny stuff in camp, right. Just like Lopez wanted to talk about his buddy spinning the pistols that he got and shooting himself by accident.
Yeah. And they probably, the Spartans complained a little bit about the food too. But Kevin, the challenge when we talk about a great book is we don't want to give too much away. We want people to go out and buy it. Folks, visit kevinmaurer.net, M-A-U-R-E-R. He also has several virtual events coming up. We'll tell you more about that when we come back. Kevin, I want you to sort of paint the scene for us, this postage stamp target that these paratroopers were jumping into when we come back. Ladies and gentlemen, Ben Bueller Garcia, stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, talking with maybe my new favorite author, Kevin Maurer. His new book is called Rock Force, one of only 10 books, I believe, Kevin, that he's published, including a New York Times number one bestseller, No Easy Day, about the mission to get bin Laden. Kevin, again, I want to talk about this book. We want people to read it, so let's not give too much away, but let's broad categories here to start. Did you visit, have you been to the island, or did you visit the island as part of your research in writing Rock Force?
I did. In 2019, I visited for a week, and an Australian historian by the name of Paul Whitman met me there, and we walked the book as much as we could. We walked to all the locations we could think of and find that take place. So, yeah, no, it's an amazing place. If you ever get to Manila and you have a day to kill, I really, really you know, recommend taking that tour. It's really a fantastic tour.
Looking at some of the photos in your book that were taken, because the other interesting thing about this, talking about modern war, is, you know, there were some cameramen and press folks that jumped in with those paratroopers and were snapping photos the whole time. And when I look at some of the, I don't know if it was a mile-long barracks or what the building was in the background, but it was already all gutted and falling down, and that's the way it looks today. At least
yeah,
one
it
of
does.
Them.
Mile-long barracks looks almost the same as it did in some of those photos. What's crazy, though, too, is I'm at mile-long barracks. We're walking around talking about where Doc Bradford had his aid station, where the headquarters was. Paul Whitman says, hey, come here. And he starts digging under some of the rubble, and he pulls out pieces of the parachute. So I have pieces of an actual parachute that was buried underneath the rubble there.
Oh, my gosh. Wow, that must have sent a little chill up your spine.
Yeah, no, that trip was amazing. And that, like I said, that battlefield looks a lot like, well, what's great about it is this: you can go on the tour and you go around in the trolley, and then there's a little resort there, and that's where I stayed. And every morning we'd get up, we'd take the trolley ride up to the top, to topside where Mile Long Barracks is, and then we would walk, and we could climb through Wheeler Battery. We could crawl down some of the ravines that you read about where they get into fights. The machine shop where they end up shooting the howitzer into it, that's open. I walked through that. I mean, it's a really an amazing, really, you can touch the battlefield more than any other place.
Now, Kevin, I got to ask Ben's dumb question every show. You know, we had Japanese soldiers, sailors turning themselves in up at least through the mid-70s. You don't worry that you weren't one of these guys weren't going to pop out from the jungle and say, hey, Kevin, you know, I'm turning myself in, or you're my prisoner. Never a problem, huh?
Oh, I think I think I deeply hope that would happen because it would make for the best epilogue in the history of World War II books.
Good point. So the Corregidor, again, we're talking, what, 3-4 miles long? In your book, you describe it as if you could imagine a tadpole of rock just sort of plunked out there in the Pacific Ocean. That's what it looks like. But the strategy was the people planning this had seen how disastrous or what the Japanese experienced when they first invaded via seaborne invasion to take the Corregidor from the Allies. We didn't want to do that again. So someone came up with this idea to jump in. But just give folks a sense, having stood there, I mean, how tough this must have been for some of those paratroopers, for all of them, I guess.
Well, yeah, no, it's an amazingly difficult jump. They did it very low, so you're only in the air, you know, for a few seconds. So you don't have a lot of time to you know, guide yourself in. And even that, at that point, like we talked about earlier, you just don't have the ability to be very precise with that. And you're looking at a crosswind that will blow you either off the top of the island and into the Pacific Ocean, or you're looking at falling into one of the ravines, which they knew were controlled by the Japanese. So, I mean, they're almost falling out. And when you mentioned that some of the correspondents didn't have the parachute training that the paratroopers had. I mean, they literally were just shoved out. And there's a great scene between Lopez and one of these correspondents when the correspondent gets shoved out. And if you read the book, you'll get a chuckle out of that one. But I mean, this was a very technical jump. It was very difficult. And the fact they were counting on, I think, 50% jump injuries, and they had a fraction of that. And I think, like I said, that speaks to just how precise they were. I mean, when you read the book, you'll see Bill Calhoun, who, for those of you who have read Band of Brothers, is our Dick Winters in Rock Force. Mm-hmm. He's a jump master, and he shows you just how precise and how well trained these guys really were.
There were some cases, and I tell you one of the stories that and there's just so many of them, but I pulled out it kind of speaks to Keller and Martin. One of the paratroopers who did drift, I guess he jumped maybe too early and ended up down the cliffside in the jungle with the Japanese. And just a powerful story of the other paratrooper who agreed to stay with him that night. And best hideout place ever, right in the back pocket of the Japanese.
That story is amazing to me. And I've seen it retold a couple times, but that, you know, Bradford tells it in his book, and then there's a couple other retellings out there. But that the how long they're hiding right in basically where the Japanese are camped is amazing. But I think the other thing that I take away from that story that I like so much is the platoon leader who doesn't give up on them. And when, as soon as he can break away from the defense at topside and get down into that ravine again to find them, he does. And I love that story. That was one of my favorite stories.
Now, the big picture here, Kevin, it wasn't just a tactical, Corregidor wasn't just of tactical importance relative to Manila, but also there was a big revenge factor at play here, not just for MacArthur, because that's, you know, I think he probably felt that he left under a little bit of a cloud when he was ordered to evacuate Corregidor by the president, but also for each of these individual paratroopers, they'd seen what had happened on the Bataan Death March, and they'd seen the way that our troops had been treated. So that this was very personal for them.
Yeah, I mean, Nykum talks about that, and I think when you open the show, that they're the jump master talking about it. I mean, this Corregidor was a stain on the American reputation in 1942 when they lose it to the Japanese. You know, at that point, Americans didn't think they would lose anything to the Japanese. And so the fact that the Imperial Army comes down and basically runs them out of the Philippines and lays siege to Corregidor and then eventually takes it is a big deal to the way that the American soldier who in 1898, when they take Corregidor and the Philippines from the Spanish, you know, Americans are now on the world stage. And this was a big blow to that mental image of what they believed the American soldier could be. And so taking Corregidor back and in the way that they do it, I think speaks to how they rebuilt sort of some pride and some back into that American soldier psyche and some national pride around it. It's an important fight on both, you know, tactically opening up the Manila Bay, but also I think of restoring some of that honor. And MacArthur talks a lot about that. And so the paratroopers.
The numbers, correct me, but so we're talking about 6,700 or so Japanese defending the island. And it turns out later we learn that they, not very well equipped, some of them, but regardless, they were, you know, even a guy with a bayonet taped to a pole, if they're fanatical and don't care about dying, can be very dangerous. But then they're lined up against about 3,000 paratroopers and 1,000 infantry. Is that about accurate, Kevin?
Yeah, that's right. And if you recall, they went in thinking they were 800 defenders. So when they get there, they're in for a rude awakening. But yeah, not all that well equipped. But the Japanese were very good defenders, mm-hmm. Because of how tenacious they were and how they would fight. They were very good at defense, and so they're very. And the terrain doesn't lend itself to attacks. So you know, you're talking about fighting in concrete batteries and in tunnels and in caves, and it's a really, really difficult fight for both sides, but the defender sort of has an advantage a little bit because of the fortifications there, which is why it was called the Rock.
Right, or Fortress Corregidor. And something else I learned from your book, Kevin, apparently, most of the Japanese soldiers, I mean, they were all rifle experts. That was something that was important to them. So a regular Japanese soldier might be a marksman in a U.S. unit. They were good shots.
Yeah, I mean, I learned a lot about the Japanese. You know, because of the covering the 82nd Airborne, I really, when I got that job in Fayetteville in 2003, dug into the 82nd World War II history. So I didn't really know much about the Japanese. I know much more about the Germans. So I learned a lot about the Japanese soldier and the way that they're trained and the way that they think. And then I was really trying to find a Japanese defender narrative to weave into this as well. But there's an expert historian who knows the Japanese Imperial Army, and he was having trouble finding it. The only thing we could find was that small, short narrative, which is what we got at the end of the book.
Kevin, I want to talk more about your book and also just some of your other experiences and the parallels that you've seen in the last 10 years working with the military. Ladies and gentlemen, if you like what you hear, Kevin's got several virtual events coming up. There's at least four in both December and January. You can find more information, register at penguinrandomhouse.com. Click on the Authors and Events tab and look for Kevin Marr. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Kevin Marr. He's a very accomplished journalist and author. I mean, Kevin, how many people, Kevin, have got a New York Times number one bestseller? Ballpark.
Oh, I'm not sure.
My producer's raising his hand. He's like, yeah, no.
I still remember when I found out that we got on the list. I remember I was still working as a reporter at the local paper, and I was covering a local government meeting, and I got the call, and I remember asking them, he's like, well, congratulations, you're on the list. And I said, well, what number? And they were like, you're number one. I would never have thought that. I still don't believe it. It just sounds funny when you read the bio, when you mention it. It's just crazy to think of it.
Well, you should, of all people, know, Kevin, don't read your own press.
Oh, trust me. I think my favorite one is when that book came out, I was called a sleazy propagandist, which is I need to make a t-shirt line with that. But
yeah,
I like that one the best.
Yeah, well, you know, you're not, how's it go? If you're not catching flack, you're not over the target. So I'd consider that a compliment as well. Speaking of over the target, one other thing that surprised me, and maybe highlights what you're saying. So Band of Brothers, you see these long sticks. I mean, all these guys jumping out of the plane forever, it seems like. But when it came to Corregidor, the transport aircraft had to make several passes. Was that because the landing zone was so small that they didn't have time for everybody to go out at once?
Exactly, right. It's just, yeah.
Okay.
It was just too small. And so, and the other thing, it's interesting you bring that up. The other thing you got to remember, too, is, you know, they didn't. The aircraft were flying in pairs when they would go over, and they would have to turn correctly. So the fact that nobody crashed into each other as they were making multiple passes over these drop zones also speaks to the coordination and the skill of this operation.
The What are the other parallels that you've seen? And again, you're sort of, Kevin, you're going back and just reading, you know, other than Mr. Lopez, you're drawing from these people's lives and personality from written documents versus the personal relationships you've had with the special forces you're embedded with. I mentioned before there seems to be a commonality in that there's almost a certain ease of the camaraderie with which they go into combat. Is that something that you personally experience when you're embedded with the special forces in today's conflicts?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a little Lloyd McCarter in all of them, in the sense that idle hands is the worst thing. I remember when I was in Iraq the first time, it was outside of this town called Asamoah, and I was with this 3rd Battalion of the 325th Airborne Infantry Regiment, and they were holed up in a train station. And between missions, a couple of the guys wandered down to one of the locomotives and got it started because they were bored. Because when they weren't on mission, they didn't really know what to do with them. I mean, they were so kind of plugged into the battle rhythm. I think all of the guys would rather be on a mission, would rather be doing something to contribute. And you know, there is a real frustration and stress level, I think, goes up. The teams I've been with that are sort of sitting there waiting for a mission or waiting for the green light. That's probably the most tense part of all of it.
Well, and maybe that's kind of like Mr. Lopez just liberating a truck and then going down to the dock and liberating supplies and then coming back and making apple pie for his fellow paratroopers.
Yep.
Nothing has changed, I guess, huh, in what, 75 years?
No, nothing. It's all still the same. I work with a good friend who was a ranger, and he tells stories about having to liberate supplies. I spent some time with a special forces team in Afghanistan, and I remember going out with them and liberating some metal, sheet metal that we ended up nailing on top of the tactical operations center because they couldn't get it officially, so we had to go and liberate it.
And was it your sense from doing your research that the part of the challenge here was every other unit had a general somewhere, but these guys, the 503rd, didn't, right? I mean, the head honcho was a lowly lieutenant colonel. And do you think that is part of the reason he was too far down on the food chain to get the supplies he needed, or that's just war?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, he didn't have a star. You need a star to get in around the table. And I think the because they only had a colonel, and because they didn't have a bigger division around them, they just weren't going to get the kind of logistical support that they needed.
The other thing that sort of saddens me, but is just the reality of it, is the parallels, I'm guessing, Kevin, is later on in the book, it becomes, and I think your quote was, death becomes familiar. And there's just a certain, folks are just have come to accept the fact that the death is a part of war and they've got to move on, whether it's right at that moment where we don't have time to recover his body, we'll have to. And, you know, one of the saddest things, you talk about some of the guys dreaming and the dead coming to them in the dream saying, why did you leave me down there with the Japanese? But that's just a practical reality of war, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think those two stories illustrate how the guys had adapted to the battlefield and to what was happening on the battlefield. I was taken by the fact that there's at least two instances that I've been able to document in the book where guys had the same dream of wounded or of soldiers that were killed in combat that day coming back to them in their dreams and asking why they were left behind. What's crazy is I'm doing work right now on a book. I'm writing a book about the air war in 1943 over Nazi Germany, and I was doing some research today. And Curtis LeMay talks about when he first gets to England and he's dealing with this attrition. They're losing so many bombers over Nazi Germany. And he, at one point, everything switches and the morale goes sky high again. And what he realized was that the bomber crews had decided, well, we're all going to die anyway, so we might not well worry about it. And that morale switched. So I think guys start to adapt to these really terrible situations. Like all humans, you know, who have gone through either natural disaster or in combat, you just start to adapt to your environment.
Kevin, I tell you, if you haven't heard of him, please look up Ralph Kid Hoffer. You like characters, you're going to love Ralph Hopper. I mean, this guy, He wore his hair long. He flew in his old football jersey. He was quite the ace. But look him up. He might find a place in your new story, your new book.
I will.
General MacArthur's comment foreshadowed or was maybe accurate. When he returned to Corregidor, he said, okay, this goes to prove that the days of fixed fortresses are long over. The final tally, 228 Americans killed, 727 wounded, 4,497 Japanese killed, 199 taken prisoner. One would call that a victory. Do you think at the end of the day, though, Kevin, was it a hollow victory? I mean, was it because it really did it matter tactically?
I mean, there's smarter historians than me, and I'm not a historian, have debated did it matter tactically or not. I mean, I think it matters. I think anytime you I'm reluctant to say that these guys sacrificed for nothing. I think it mattered to them. It becomes the identity of 503rd now. I mean, they still have the patch that was designed after this operation. I think the ripple effect down into the future, it mattered. Yeah, I think it matters. I mean, I think you need to take that island. And it sits at the mouth. It is of a strategic importance into the mouth of Manila Bay. And if they hadn't dropped the two atomic bombs and they had to have staged enough troops to get to Tokyo, I think you'd need Manila as a logistics point. So you need that island. You can't just leave the Japanese on it. So I think it matters.
Ladies and gentlemen, the book is Rock Force. I read it literally almost in one sitting, all except for about two chapters. I would highly recommend it. You can find that. Visit kevinmaurer.net, M-A-U-R-E-R.net. Kevin does have some, it's time of COVID, so he's got some virtual book tours coming up. Those are coming up December 9th, January 22nd, January 28th. You can find more information, register at penguinrandomhouse.com. Click on the authors and event tab and look for Kevin Maurer. Kevin, thank you so much for spending some of your time with us this weekend.
Thank you, Ben. I really appreciate it. Thank you for the kind words about the book.
Loved it. Always great. Always great to get a good book. Ladies and gentlemen, check us out on Facebook. This podcast and over close to 300 others can be found at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. As I mentioned, we're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We just got approved for Spotify. If you're a Spotify subscriber, check us out there. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care of yourselves.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.